Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a preview of what may be a turning point in U.S. politics. Reaction to talks underway on the Syrian crisis. We speak with a Peshmerga commander in Makmur, Iraq, about the fight against IS. And Pink Floyd's legendary Dark Side of the Moon album is almost 40 years old.
The critics raved about it. They said it was some of the best music Pink Floyd had ever made.
It's coming up right here on The Voice of America. It's another big day in the race for the White House Tuesday. U.S. presidential candidates are competing in five delegate-rich states. Our senior national correspondent, Jim Malone, has joined us here in the studio to give us a bit of a preview. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Susan.
Hey, please explain why tomorrow is just so important.
Five big states are voting. It'll affect both party candidates. Particularly, we're looking at the Republican race right now. There's two states to watch, Ohio and Florida. If Donald Trump can sweep all five states, he would be well on his way to the Republican nomination. It looks like the biggest challenge to Trump on Tuesday will come in Ohio. That's where the home state governor, John Kasich, is running well, according to the latest public opinion polls. That's a close race. The other state, Florida, 99 Republican delegates at stake. Both Ohio and Florida are winner-take-all, so you just win the popular vote, you get all the delegates. And the polling right now shows a big advantage for Trump, double digits ahead of Marco Rubio. If Rubio does not really win in Florida on Tuesday, I'm sure there'll be a lot of calls for him to get out of the race.
What about the Democrats?
Well, we have the same five states featuring the Democratic contest. Hillary Clinton is leading, according to the polls, in most of those, particularly in Florida, also in Ohio. It looks like Illinois, which is another of the states voting on Tuesday, there's a fairly narrow gap there between Clinton and her main challenger, Bernie Sanders. So Sanders surprised at Michigan last week. He was well down in the polls. Who knows? We could see more surprises on Tuesday.
Well, meanwhile, candidates from both parties are giving a hard time to Republican frontrunner Donald Trump. And that's because of all the violence that has erupted at his rallies, even though he denies there's a lot of violence. The cameras show us people punching each other and jumping around and being taken out of the venues.
Yeah, we had a Friday night rally in Chicago that was canceled. Trump canceled it after stirring protests, at the venue. Kansas City, there were protests inside and outside the debate or the speech venue where he spoke. It's taken a really kind of serious turn over the last several days. Now, Sunday and so far on Monday, it's been a little calmer. But I think this does have, especially members of the Republican establishment, a little concerned. Trump is defiant in these rallies, is blaming outside agitators for causing the demonstrations.
He even mentioned Sanders.
Yeah, he's even mentioned Bernie Sanders. Sanders says that Trump is a pathological liar. So the elevation of debate hasn't really happened, and we are seeing these disturbances. We'll see if they continue. If they do, it's going to give the Republicans pause, even at the moment when it looks as though Trump is moving toward the nomination.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jim, and I know we'll be speaking with you later this week after all the excitement's over.
Look forward to it.
Thanks. And joining us here with the latest on what's being said in social media on this topic is our social media reporter, Andrew Palchewski. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Oh, thank you. What's going on?
Well, as the candidates are crisscrossing the country to these different states, we're following along on social media. So a lot of excitement at these rallies for the primaries upcoming tomorrow, and people using words on social media like pivotal, saying that tomorrow could be the day where Donald Trump really surges ahead. People saying, his Trump supporters are saying on social media he already has, but others saying that this tomorrow could be a really big turning point in that race.
Are the candidates still really using a lot of social media as they have been in the past?
Oh, absolutely. Not just as an outreach tool, which many of them are saying, get out to the polls, here's how you vote early, here's how you register to vote. But you're getting an inside look as they're going through these different campaign stops and rallies. You're seeing them retweet people, campaign supporters that are out there at these rallies. So it's really connecting them with a lot of the voters. Both of these rallies, who they're maybe retweeting some of them, sharing their photos, but also throughout the country.
Well, Jim and I were just talking about the violence. Have people been exaggerating their positions online, being violent with a tweet? as far as their opinions? Is it really extreme out there?
It is to an extent. Certainly when you get people in social media and you have a level of anonymity and separation from being in real life, people can say some very mean things. But there are a lot of people on social media saying that even this weekend was a turning point in the sense that we've now reached a level of violence at some of these rallies that they never thought they would see. They're very concerned. And a lot of people sharing a message saying, you know, political debates are one thing. We can't make this a physical confrontation between Trump supporters and protesters or any other campaign and anyone else.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Andrew. Appreciate you stopping by, as always.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to both. Well, this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of researchers say that they have discovered around 80 galaxies that may have existed in the young universe about 12.6 billion years ago. The team developed a list of galaxies to look for from data gathered by the Subaru telescope in Hawaii. With that information, they were able to locate these 80 early galaxies and learn more about them by analyzing imaging data gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope. About 13.6 billion years ago, that's 200 million years after the Big Bang, it's thought that cold gas clouds provided material for the first stars to be born. As these stars were being created, they formed small galaxies. The researchers were able to determine that around 1.2 billion years after the Big Bang, these small galaxies were continuously merging together and growing into larger galaxies like our own Milky Way, which contains about 200 billion stars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The latest round of proximity talks on Syria's political future are being held today in Geneva, more than 2 weeks after a cessation of hostilities brought most of the fighting to a halt. The government and opposition remain at odds over a key issue, the future of President Bashar al-Assad. The main opposition High Negotiations Committee has indicated the talks should focus on creating a transitional governing body, and Mr. Assad must leave. But Foreign Minister Walid al-Mulam said his delegation will not talk to anyone who wants to discuss the presidency. Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity College in San Antonio, Texas, tells VOA's Victor Beatty via Skype, Damascus, backed by Russia's air campaign, has no incentive now to compromise with a weakened opposition.
On the battlefield, they've made gains. Most of the international community, at least those that have been backing the opposition, have shown some flexibility regarding his position in any sort of transition process, or flexibility regarding whether or not he can remain in power. So from his point of view, stay the course. I think before any negotiations anyhow, both sides are going to take maximalist positions and then leave open the possibility to negotiate. I think that's probably the opposition point of view. I think from the point of view of the Syrian regime, I mean, there's no way the negotiators are going to go there and negotiate the ouster of their boss. I mean, it's a non-starter from their point of view, as Syrian Foreign Minister Walid Mualim said. And I happen to know that, you know, in any sort of Syrian government negotiating team, you have those who are out front, but there are those with more power who are in the background. And they're the ones that, you know, really are pulling the strings on behalf of Bashar al-Assad. And they will keep Bashar al-Assad informed, and they'll make sure the negotiators who are in the public eye stay the course. So this is not surprising to me at all. I personally do not think the Syrian regime has any intention of stepping aside. And they have repeated the mantra, as has the Russians, that it's up to the Syrian people to decide and not the subject of negotiations.
Are these doomed to fail?
If that becomes the sticking issue, if the Syrian opposition holds to that position that they won't go any further without any guarantees that Assad will step down, it will go no further, and they will break down. And especially at this point in the game, in terms of Syrian government now being assertively backed by Russian military involvement and having made gains in the battlefield, there's no reason for them to make these sort of concessions from their point of view at this time.
Could this threaten the cessation of hostilities, in your view?
Absolutely, it could threaten it. I think what Secretary of State Kerry is doing is trying to pressure his Russian counterparts to compel the Syrian government negotiating team to be a little bit more flexible. But I just don't see that happening right now.
But David Lesh also believes the U.S. does not see Russian involvement in the conflict as open-ended, and, given the upcoming U.S. election, believes it has some leverage with Moscow to get a political agreement done on Syria before November. Coming up on International Edition, word from a possible front line in the fight for Mosul. And we visit the dark side of the moon. VOA's Sharon Bain and Ali Javan Mardi traveled to Makmur, Iraq, to the last Peshmerga base in the front line against Islamic State, or Daesh. The town and surrounding villages were retaken from IS after a bloody two-month battle in 2014. And Makmur is expected to be one of the staging points for the different military forces being gathered in the battle for Mosul. We asked the Peshmerga commander of the sector, Major General Sirwan Barzani, about the role of Sunni tribes in the fight against Islamic State in Mosul.
They are good to get some information from Daesh, from inside, and as an intelligence, because they have families, cousins in Daesh area. And also it's good for future. When we go forward, we need to push Daesh back from the Sunni villages. So they will locate it there. They will holding the land. We don't want to push the Peshmerga there.
How many forces will be involved in the fight for Mosul?
We don't know how many soldiers, how many Iraqi army, how many Peshmerga they will attend, and how many they will be Hashd al-Sha'bi, the Shia militia or not. They will be coalition troops on ground, and only will be with the air support or airstrike. So all this, it's with the final plan that we can tell you. But it's not easy for sure, especially if there is only, they will be only Iraqi army. It's so difficult. So, you know, it's not only to push Daesh back, you have to hold the land also. So I think at least they need 25,000 Iraqi army, at least for this operation, and almost 10,000 Peshmerga.
What is needed from the United States?
Of course, we need everything, if they can do, if they will help. The airstrike is very helpful, of course, but it's not enough, especially only with the F-16 or F-18. There is no helicopters, attack helicopters like Apache. It's more important than the F-16 or F-18. And I don't think there will be troops on ground, really. If there will be troops on ground with the Pesh, with the Iraqi army, of course, they will be helpful and they will be faster as an operation against to push Daesh back from Mosul. Really, we from our side as a Peshmerga, we are ready. We need maximum 2 to 3 weeks. And we are ready, but we don't get the plan yet. We don't have the plan yet, and we have to wait from Iraqi.
The general is concerned about IS using chemical weapons.
Many times the chlorine gas is used for all sectors in Kurdistan, and especially my sector. But last year, 2015, was 11th of August. First time they're using the mustard gas for 3 times in the same month. And of course, with more than 120 kilometers, so I have 300 masks only for all the Peshmerga. I think so, for sure. And they will try to make it better and better.
General Barzani says there are 2 or 3 large training centers in Mosul where IS is starting to train 8 to 18-year-olds to commit suicide attacks. German Chancellor Angela Merkel's ruling Christian Democratic Union suffered an electoral defeat in Sunday's regional elections, primarily over her migration policy that has allowed more than 1 million asylum seekers, mostly from the Middle East and South Asia, in over the past year. Voters opted for the relatively new Alternative for Germany party. Hanna Cleaver, a freelance reporter for Deutsche Welle, says the outcome is somewhat complicated because voters were sending 2 messages.
The first most surprising thing for an international audience, perhaps, is that a large number of them have told Angela Merkel, we do not like your policy of allowing migrants and largely refugees coming into Germany without any restrictions. And it seems there are a lot of people in Germany who are very unhappy with that. You've had more than 1 million people come into Germany over the last year. And one of the clear messages to Merkel was, this is upsetting an awful lot of people in Germany. The second message to Merkel is really a more complicated internal domestic German question, but is also also useful to look at from an international perspective, it is that people are still actually largely in favor of this policy. This is German people speaking with two tongues, if you like. One of the newspapers today had the very sarcastic headline, 85% of voters remain cool, which is actually also the case. Her party herself, itself, the CDU, was punished at the polls. But her policy of allowing Syrian refugees into the country, of welcoming them, of pulling out all the stops possible to actually increase and encourage integration of refugees into Germany, that was largely supported, even though it was supported then by other parties than her own. So it is a complicated picture, but you do have this shocking for outsiders results, particularly in this eastern state of Saxony and Anhalt, where you had just over 24% of people voting for this Alternative for Deutschland party, which was set up initially to oppose European Union and has now turned into a very critical, one might even say, anti-refugee party.
As for Ms. Merkel's own political future, Cleaver says as of now she has no rival who comes anywhere near her stature, and she seems safe for re-election to a fourth term. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
The passage of time is a common musical theme. It relates to all of us. Pink Floyd's legendary Dark Side of the Moon album devoted much of its outpouring to the subject, including a track titled Time. Now, 43 years of time has passed since it was released. Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald spoke with VOA's Jim Stevenson about Dark Side of the Moon, which remains a huge fan favorite.
It's an ageless album, Jim. On March 10th, 1973, Harvest Records released Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd in the United States. And this was an album that the band had been working on for quite some time. They had developed the songs during live performances, and they performed an early version of the album in February 1972 at the Rainbow Theatre in London, a full year before the album was released.
And weren't those fans lucky, and they didn't know.
Exactly. The critics raved about it. They said it was some of the best music Pink Floyd had ever made. The album itself was recorded from June 1972 to January 1973 at the famous Abbey Road Studios in London. And it was a unified piece of music. The songs flowed into each other using special sound effects and spoken word excerpts. It took a lot of the concepts and ideas that Pink Floyd had used in their earlier albums. This was their eighth album. Mm. But it was a much more unified piece of work than anything they'd done before. It looked at themes of greed, the passage of time, themes of mental illness, which was partly inspired by the mental breakdown of one of their founding members, Syd Barrett, in the late 60s. And people absolutely responded to it. Roger Waters, their bassist, said that he played the album for his wife, and she burst into tears at the end of it. So he says, right at that moment, I knew that we were going to find an audience. It certainly did. Dark Side of the Moon remained on the U.S. album charts for 741 total weeks from 1973 to 1988. And no other album has done this.
That's astounding.
It only was number one for 1 week, but it hung around the charts for 741 total weeks. The album sold an estimated 45 million copies worldwide. It's one of the best-selling albums of all time. And moreover, Dark Side of the Moon elevated Pink Floyd from a respected mid-level rock band to a global superstar act, where they remained right up until the end of their career.
Technology also helped this album because we were so familiar with it, and by the time the 90s rolled around and CDs came out, we had almost a fresh listen to it.
Yeah, it was always a favorite among headphone listeners because of the depth of the production and the complexity of it all. FM radio stations of the 1970s would often play the entire record side as one track flowed into the next. In addition, it had a couple hit singles, Time, mm-hmm. Money. Everybody knew the music, and it seemed like every subset of music fans found something to like about it. Its appeal went right across the board, and it is 43 years old this week.
Speaking of numbers, we like our favorite number. That's the top 20 countdown. Ray McDonald is your host. Ray's also on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Follow him. Listen to him. Thanks for joining us, Ray.
Thank you, Jim.
The time is gone. The song is over. Thought I'd something more to say.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The periodic warming of sea surface temperatures in the Pacific Ocean, known as El Niño, causes weather and short-term climate changes in other parts of the globe. The El Niño of 2015-2016 is the strongest on record, and nowhere have been extreme weather effects associated with El Niño been more intensely felt than in Ethiopia. Last summer's Kirimt, or main rainy season, has been weak, and the short spring bell grains are delayed. According to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the resulting drought, the worst Ethiopia has experienced in 5 decades, has led to successive crop failures and widespread livestock deaths, tripling the humanitarian needs. Some 10.2 million Ethiopians are now chronically hungry, while some 7.5 million farmers and herders need immediate agricultural support to produce both grains and livestock in the coming season. Since October 2014, the United States has provided over $500 million in aid to Ethiopia and another $4 million worth of seeds, a critical need for farmers, given that the planting season will begin soon. But this year, we are taking an extra step, one we feel is necessary if we are to prevent this crisis from growing much, much worse. Instead of waiting for the situation to develop into a full-blown emergency, we are sending in a disaster assistance response team, a group of experts that will evaluate the situation on the ground, pinpoint gaps in the aid plan, and accelerate and expand the emergency response, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. We are moving earlier in this case because we have found that there is real agreement between donors, NGOs, the government, and UN agencies that if we move very, very quickly, we can avert the worst impacts of this drought. We hope that by taking this step, we will lead the rest of the international community, said Administrator Smith. If we move now, if other donors move with us, we think we can do 2 things. Avert the worst impacts and protect some of the development gains that the country has made over many years, she said. We are challenging the world not just to respond to human suffering, but to respond quickly enough to prevent something even worse.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.